What is it called?
I think we should start over.
Do you want to start over? We could start all the way over. I was just gonna edit.
Okay, I think we should start over.
Okay, it's called. What is it called? Western. It's Suicide of the West.
Suicide of the West. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right, we'll start over. Okay. Welcome to Know Your Enemy, a podcast where we explore American conservatism in all its guises and disguises.
I don't know if this works, Sam.
Okay, welcome to Know Your Enemy, the podcast where two leftists... Yet another podcast where two leftist bros guide you through the swampy morass of... The American right. Why?
Right.
Did I introduce you? My co-host, my co-host is Matthew James Sittman. He insists on being called by all three of his names at all times.
Right. This is an homage to the right, just like, you know.
Right. Or like school shooters. look, we can edit. but I guess my question is, Matt, why in the world would we want to do a podcast, for one, for two, about the American right?
Well, first of all, one reason to do it is because Sam and I have fun talking about these things. We talk about them all the time. But you know, there's certainly a glut, you might say, of
understatement
of socialist bros, whatever, doing podcasts. But Sam and I aren't funny, so this isn't a comedy podcast.
We're not,
and we mostly want to talk about American conservatism and the American right. In part because it's worth talking about because they're in power, mm-hmm. and their conservatives are a major force in American political life, and so just for that reason alone, they're worth trying to understand. But also, I would say Sam and I have, not to speak for you, Sam, but
seems like you are. Go on.
A kind of long-running fascination with the American right.
Yeah,
and the so-called intellectuals that have comprised the movement, as long as the more popular expressions of it.
Right. So we're going to know our enemies.
Right.
Which the title of our podcast, Know Your Enemy.
Right. Now, I should say, as a Christian, you can know and love your enemies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is not by using the word enemy. It's not meant to be,
And as a Jew, we believe in judgment, striking down from on high our enemies, crushed.
Right. but anyways, that's one of the driving impulse to try another podcast or put another podcast out into the world is because we thought this might be a little different.
Yeah.
And it would be about people and about a movement and about topics that are generally not being discussed that much, or at least not seriously,
on the
left.
There's an argument to be made that the right can be very perceptive about the movements of the left, that the right understands things about the left that sometimes the left doesn't understand about itself, because I mean, one theory of conservatism that I'm partial to, but not entirely wedded to, is the way that Corey Robin, the intellectual historian philosopher, writes about conservatism, which is to say that conservatism is, in essence, a reactionary impulse.
That's the title of the book, The Reactionary Mind.
Right, which I, in fact, have right here in front of me. And he has a good definition of conservatism in the beginning of the book, which is that conservatism is a meditation on and theoretical rendition of the felt experience of having power, seeing it threatened, and trying to win it back, which... You know, we're going to talk about a lot of different definitions of conservatism, but that one is an interesting place to start in some ways and does kind of animate my interest in conservatism, because I think that if you're engaged in a philosophical theoretical enterprise that's focused on the experience of having and then losing power or feeling power threatened, you're going to be very perceptive and sensitive to the movements that pose a threat to that power. So that I think that sometimes when we're going to be talking about conservatism, we're going to be gleaning insights about the left.
I think that's a good place to start. But I would say, too, personally, my interest in the right is as an ex-conservative.
A recovered conservative.
A recovering conservative.
We have a real specimen on our hands.
Yeah, here. Yeah. So I've written about this before. A couple years ago, I wrote an essay for Dissent magazine called Leaving Conservatism Behind. I grew up in a small town in central Pennsylvania.
We'll put that in the show notes.
Right, we'll put that in the show notes.
We're going to have show notes.
I grew up in a small town in a kind of very working class family, a town that was mostly working class. I, you know, went to a small evangelical college as an undergraduate. And was kind of plugged into the conservative movement as a young grad student. And then, you know, over the course of my 20s, slowly moved left. And we can talk about all this, but my interest is partly, as we've discussed, like it's important to me to understand these things because of the political moment we're living through. But I would also say that I just have this sort of personal backstory, and I'm genuinely fascinated by the conservative movement and especially conservative history. I mean, some of these figures we'll discuss I've known personally or mm-hmm. or knew their students or just had, I was in a milieu in which these ideas were discussed. And so it's very interesting to me too to understand the conservative movement from the inside and then now what right. I see or understand about it from the outside. And
part of what I'm going to do is try to surface the most lurid stories from Matt's conservative past, all the secret rituals, etc., that he was involved in,
right?
The various obscure tattoos that he has relating to Strauss or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I would also say that, I mean, Sam, you mentioned, you know, the right's perceptiveness about the left, which is true. But I also think the left can learn certain things from the right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not an embittered ex-conservative in the sense of being mistreated or having some professional,
right.
You know, I'm, it's not like I'm David Frum, who was, you know, fired from AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, and now, you know, that's like a major element of my biography. I was treated really well right. during my time as a conservative, and I was mentored
better,
really
perhaps,
well.
Because they have money.
Right, yeah, no, they're incredibly supportive of young thinkers and young writers, and there really is a kind of pipeline that develops and cultivates talent that I think there's no exact equivalent mm-hmm. to on the left.
Right.
In part because most mainstream institutions are roughly some kind of mainstream liberalism, right?
Yeah.
Which doesn't really help you if you're a real committed lefty.
Right.
But, you know, mainstream institutions are sort of some kind of moderate centrist liberalism, and the right, by feeling themselves to be an embittered minority, an insurgency even, has they were forced to develop their own institutions
right.
Outside of the mainstream institutions to cultivate talent and build power. One thing the right does very well, too, is to give young conservatives a sense of identity.
Yeah.
And I mean that in the sense of being a part of something.
Right.
I mean, if you're a young conservative, and maybe I'll just speak for myself, but when I was one, you felt very much both a part of something in the moment, sort of a besieged minority, you know,
right.
set upon by politically correct professors
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a mainstream media that was hostile to your convictions. And sort of the general drift of secularized
right.
culture, and you know, you can kind of run through a list of people who were, you felt were arrayed against you, but also you were taught something about conservative history,
right.
Like you would be told and taught and understand that you know, FDR was elected president, and the New Deal happened, and then this kind of brave band of dissident intellectuals slowly.
A noble few.
Right. The remnant,
right.
you might say.
The remnant, yeah.
Using
our friend Albert Goldberg, friend of the podcast, John
right.
Goldberg.
I mean, and he was taking that from Albert J. Nock, who was kind of someone like the Bill Buckley
right.
looked to, and he was kind of a, you know, early 20th century dissenting libertarianish
right.
figure.
We should do a podcast episode on him.
We really should. But you were kind of taught that that you came from somewhere, that there was a real history, that the turn in American political life that roughly happened around the New Deal, and then the kind of welfare state, and along with, the general drift, as I mentioned, of American culture and politics.
Which is to say, the civil rights movement,
that's
feminism.
Part of it. There's kind of layers to it or stages to it, against these kind of array of forces. Bill Buckley founded National Review.
Right.
And someone like Hayek, published The Road to Serfdom.
Right.
And then it is a kind of Whiggish history of conservatism itself, in that it started with the libertarian critique of the welfare state, and then you had the Cold War anti-communism was a layer to it, against the kind of fecklessness of
the liberals,
who were kind of soft on the Soviet Union. Then you had the religious right. This history is recounted, and it gives the conservative identity a kind of coherence and sense of history, and where you've come from and where you're going.
Right. It's a just-so story, and it also gives you, as a young intellectual, a place to fit inside that story, into that story, that you're a standard bearer of this noble few.
You're the latest in a long line of brave kind of truth-telling thinkers and writers.
And I'm going to ask you more questions about your early history as a firebrand conservative intellectual. I should say that I was not a former conservative.
No. You wouldn't exactly call yourself a red diaper baby.
It's like as close to that. I think that maybe if people use that term more loosely, then I would qualify. But my parents weren't literally communist. But my dad is a socialist labor lawyer, and my mother she works for legal aid. So they're both like lefty lawyer types. And I certainly grew up around the labor movement. I think, so my interest in conservatism is more, lurid and prurient and from the outside. I don't have as good a justification for why you should listen to me about conservatism, except for that I'm very interested in it, and I really enjoy talking to Matt about it, especially because he has unique insights to share. And I guess if you're trying to decide whether it'd be worth listening to us talk about this topic, you can think of it as Matt with some insider knowledge, and me with in part being led along through this sort of swampy mess of intellectual history and political movements.
Yeah.
But also I think that as a person who grew up very, very much in a kind of liberal and leftist household, I'm not really from New York, my dad's from New York, but he's very much a New York Jewish socialist, and that's a big, tradition in the labor left. So I'm kind of a caricature of my own, of my own type.
Uh-huh. Well, I would say too, to give you some credit, Sam, it'd be wrong to say you're not sympathetic to conservative ideas, but I would say at the level of intellectual method, you're committed to actually understanding these ideas on their own terms in a non-caricatured way, at least at the start.
Yeah.
And
I think we do a better job of unpacking and drilling down into the layers of this ideology if we approach it with some amount of good faith.
Good faith is the I think the term I would use.
And because I think that the way I've been thinking about conservatives lately, as I've been reading more of them and writing more about them, is there was a tendency on the left. Among left intellectuals, liberal intellectuals, especially in the Bush years, I think, to treat conservative intellectual thought as either stupid or motivated exclusively by kind of raw and quite explicit animus towards particular disenfranchised social groups, which, of course, that's a big part of what conservatism is, but it isn't the way that conservatism presents itself, and we lose a lot of the kind of nuance of how that ideology is constructed and why it's so effective for a lot of people if we assume from the jump that that it's all just a facade and everyone's secretly inside their heads thinking, I just hate black people, I just hate women, yeah. I just hate gay people.
Well, it's, you know, I would say almost every history of conservatism, at least modern American conservatism, post-war American conservatism, begins with that damn... a line from Lionel Trilling that there's that conservatism.
It's all emotional feeling.
Well, it's irritable mental gestures resembling ideas or something right. like that. Or the Louis Hart's book, The Liberal Tradition in America, which I think came out in the 1950s, that liberalism was the only tradition in the only real intellectual political tradition in the United States.
Right. And this is another thing. This is another thing that we. I'm probably going to bring up Corey Robin a lot, and you know, he also militates against that attitude towards conservatism, Trilling's attitude, because if you think it's only feeling, then you're not going to pay attention to the ideas, and you're not going to understand mm-hmm. that there is really a lot of heft to the kind of intellectual nuts and bolts of this ideology, mm-hmm. and that it is. And he, you know, he is an intervention in sort of a way of reading conservative intellectual history. Robin says that it is a very sophisticated set of ideas. What mm-hmm. those ideas are about is, you know, the experience of losing power or being threatened mm-hmm. by mass movements of various kinds. But it takes quite a lot of that tension, that fear, and that experience produces. A lot of serious ideas.
Yeah.
Seriously bad ideas, in my opinion, obviously.
We or at least complex that. And interesting ideas.
Yeah, complex and complex and interesting. It produces yeah. lots of unserious ideas, and we'll probably talk about those too.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing about your kind of discussion of the feeling of being part of this noble tradition of the American right when you're a young intellectual is that you can hear in sort of today's conservative pundits, some of them trying to lay claim to that legacy, and frankly, some of them like actually don't have the firepower that their predecessors mm-hmm. did.
Well, there's, I actually think, I'm fairly certain it was a Pat Buchanan line. Pat Buchanan, who I met briefly.
We'll
come back to that. But he has a great line that like, all political movements, well, they begin as movements, become businesses and uh-huh. then degenerate into rackets,
uh-huh.
right? Like there's a kind of natural history of political movements where there is some kind of freshness and fervor
right.
to the ideas at the start, and then they become institutionalized and then degenerate into kind
websites
of grifters.
That sell swag.
Yeah, you get Glenn Beck selling bars of gold and packets of food for your bomb
right.
shelter or whatever.
So let's let's talk a little bit more about the Matt Simmons story.
Sure.
Because I think it's also interesting that you should really read Matt's essay on leaving conservatism in Dissent, because it's very, very lucid account of this conversion mm-hmm. experience of
yeah.
sorts. And I think there's a couple of other elements that I want to ask you about, which is, one thing, you know, you didn't grow up in a household of conservative intellectuals,
right? Yeah. In fact, I mean, to not to quote Pat Buchanan again, although I know we're rambling a bit, but Pat Buchanan is interesting to me because he was Trump,
yeah,
before Trump, and or the ideas and kind of impulses he circled around definitely sort of were sure that there was some constituency for something like Trumpism before.
There's also a great essay in The Baffler by John Gans.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone
yeah,
should
absolutely
read
yeah.
About Buchanan and 1992. It's called The Year the Clock Broke.
But
you were going to say...
Yeah, Buchanan called it the conservatism of the heart.
You grew up with the conservatism of the heart.
Right, a kind of instinctive patriotism... a general belief in the goodness of America. Also a story about upward mobility.
Right.
Neither of my parents went to college. As I said, I grew up very working class.
Trump country.
The county I grew up in went, the congressional wound up, the county I grew up in went like 72% for Trump. Uh-huh. My zip code went even more for Trump.
Yeah.
But a kind of story that, you know, my parents didn't go to college, but I would.
Right.
And that would mean something for my life trajectory.
Yeah.
Also, in my own case, a very conservative, self-described fundamentalist religion, mm-hmm. Baptist fundamentalist.
Yeah.
So you put all those things together, and it amounted to a kind of just instinctive conservatism.
Right.
You know, it's also interesting in Pennsylvania because my parents, I don't want to speak for them, but
we'll have them on the pod.
Right. I want to say when they first like turned 18 and could register to vote, they registered as Democrats, mm-hmm. because it was like that was the Democratic Party of Bob Casey Sr., mm-hmm. the kind of pro-life labor Democrat type.
Right.
And they so I kind of grew up both in a family, but I would say more generally like in an area that really they were people who were called Reagan Republicans,
right.
meaning or Reagan Democrats, I should right. say, people who essentially entered the Republican Party, whether formally in terms of registration or just with their votes at first, in that period of time where they kind of left the Democratic Party behind and became Reaganite Republicans, along with, you know, this wasn't a fluke. I mean, Reagan,
right.
you know, won, what, 49 states in 1984.
Yeah.
So, but they kind of exemplify that, like white working class people who a few decades ago would have been reliably Democratic voters
right.
who became Republicans or started voting for the Republican Party sometime in the early to mid 80s.
Right. And so that was sort of the mode of conservatism that you grew up with.
Right.
You went to college and then right. graduate school.
Right.
How much of a PhD do you have?
I'm ABD. So all but dissertation, as it said. So yeah, I went to a very conservative evangelical undergraduate institution, college. Private liberal arts college, and then I went straight through to Georgetown University to do a PhD in political theory. But it was at Georgetown where I took a graduate seminar in American conservatism with the great historian Michael Kazin, who also is the editor of Dissent and would later publish the essay
right.
"Leaving Conservatism Behind." He asked me to write it, actually, and you know that. That seminar was interesting because it kind of took my own experiences and instincts. And even then, you know, I had interned at a major conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., which I prefer not to say.
Folks, we'll get that out of him by the end of this podcast. Not this episode, but...
Yeah, literally the summer before I started graduate school. But I remember the very first day of that seminar, you know, you go around the table and you introduce yourself. Michael Kazin... I don't think he'd mind me saying this. He said, you know, I'm a card-carrying member of the American left, which anyone who knows Michael at all or has access to Google would be able to find out. You know, he was in Weatherman as a
right.
as a young man and, you know, kind of long history on the left. But he said, I'm teaching this class because I want to understand why we're losing. This
right.
was kind of during Bush's second term, sort of before Bush's second term really went south.
Mm-hmm.
So it was there was a real sense of, being besieged, you know, the Iraq war
right.
was going on. This guy who, you know, had lost the popular vote in 2000 was reelected. There was a you know, real sense of, like I said, being besieged on among liberals and the left. And
so he was, in a sense, trying to know his enemy.
He was. And it was a great, he was probably the best teacher I ever had. And it was a great seminar. And I mentioned that Kazin said, I'm a card-carrying member of the left, and I'm trying to, you know, understand why we're losing. And by the time we went around the table and it got to me, I said, I'm Matt Sittman. I'm a card-carrying member of the American right. And but in some ways, I do think that was when... You
That's
know, that
when
was,
we started to get our hooks in you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for a lot of reasons... one was just, you know, when you grow up in a small town in a fairly rural kind of area and then you go to a small Christian college, you know, moving to D.C. and going to grad school was just simply like experientially a certain kind of thing for me.
Right.
And you have teachers, you know, especially as I mentioned, you're on the right. You're taught that all the professors at major universities are these kind of horrible PC,
right,
you know, indoctrinating teachers. And that wasn't my experience at all. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of great teachers who were, you know, significantly to my left at the time. But also, yeah, just being in a place like Washington, it was just a different social experience for me. So part of it, I would say that the cracks in my conservatism first came just through the position, what my position was in the world.
Right.
And I don't know how much we want to get into it now, but I would say too, one of the most important things that shook me up early on, I'm talking when I'm, you know, 24, 25 years old, mm-hmm. Was torture in the Iraq War. And it was just, torture was obviously morally wrong.
Yeah.
And the people sort of around me in the conservative movement, my conservative friends.
Where did that moral conviction come from for you?
I mean, this where it was probably my, to simplify, my Christianity. Just like you should not treat people created in the image of God this way.
Yeah.
And I think any sensible person knows it's not really effective.
Yeah.
And
the people around you on the right were...
They're kind of defending it. Or they took my criticisms of it as, you know... And I'm not trying to paint with too broad of a brush. You know, maybe the people I was hanging out with were, you know, particularly naive or... I'm not saying every conservative justified torture. I'm just saying that for me was, as the Iraq War went south and torture rose to the fore as an issue, those were major, major occasions to rethink what my assumptions were and sort of the kind of ideas that were being fed to me that I took too uncritically, you might say.
So if you had started out in this household where there was a conservatism of the heart and part of that being this kind of striving upward, upward mobility, my kid's going to be better off than I was, that America uniquely provides the possibility of that kind of upward trajectory. How did that part of it start to feel false if it did?
Oh,
like I'm talking about meritocracy just.
Yeah.
General.
Well, it feels self-referential to mentioned my dissent essay again, but really it's called Leaving Conservatism Behind. But when I wrote it, the title I gave it that the editors wisely rejected, I think, but I wanted to call it Late to Class, which is to say the essay is really about a belated class consciousness.
Right.
In the sense that when you grow up simply among other working class people, it's the water, it's like a fish doesn't know it's in water, right? There was nothing to compare it against. What I like to tell people is there was no old money in central Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. There was no kind of aristocratic class. There was no kind of, you know, highly educated, richer group of people that I felt myself in opposition to. Most people were simply, you know, working class. Most of my friends' parents didn't have college degrees, or if they did, you know, maybe it was something really practical, like an engineering degree, or, you know. So I didn't have any sense of being like working class per se, or any sense really of class consciousness, and that came to me as I moved through the world and was at a place like Georgetown.
Yeah.
And saw just a certain kind of person, or I should say, you know, people who came from a certain kind of family that was totally beyond my experiences.
Yeah.
The amount of money they had, the kind of schools they went to, the private schools they went to, the undergraduate educations they had. And then eventually, I did teach for a few years at the University of Virginia on like a doctoral fellowship where I was supposed to be writing my dissertation and teaching. But being in the South and kind of experiencing old money or like the decayed Southern aristocracy and seeing, you know, what race was like in a place like Virginia, the race relations, if you want to call it that, that was important too. So I would say, you know, it's not like I woke up one day and said, oh, meritocracy is bullshit. Yeah. I mean, I do kind of think that.
Yeah.
But it's more, I would describe it as a kind of delayed class consciousness.
Right.
In part because I needed...
Something to compare it to.
And my travels in life took me
places and put me in situations where I very much felt, sort of realized just what my childhood and upbringing was like.
Right.
What it really meant.
Yeah, and even, I mean, I would say, even growing up with a very sort of in a progressive household and a, you know, what people call upper middle class, you know, professional class parents, I went to Brown, and I had never encountered people with that kind of money. Right. Like, that's crazy money. Mm-hmm. And
did you go to a public high school?
Yeah, I went to a public high school.
That in itself is, you meet people who did not go to public high school.
Oh, yeah, right. And part of it initially manifests as like, wow, you had a really great education. I mean, my education was good. I loved my public school. But like, you read all these books, and you like are conversant with this intellectual tradition. Like, the people that I was impressed with when I first got to school. But then finding out just about the truly aristocratic backgrounds of some of the people that I was impressed with, I was also like, wow, well, this is, I mean, I had class consciousness of a sort, or at least I had been taught about class by my dad and my mother. Mm-hmm. But I had class rage for the first time when I was an undergrad, which is when I got involved with sort of labor organizing and student activism. But yeah, I mean, there's something that happens when you realize that there are these just massive quantities of wealth that are inherited mm-hmm. and passed down generation to generation for no good reason at all, and that it isn't a mistake that those people end up at the top of you know, whatever, at these very, very good schools or succeeding extremely well. This is very simple what we're describing here, but it's from my perspective, I can hear some of that in what you're describing, even though I didn't start out with a really, really high degree of confidence in meritocracy, or at least, you know, I had this sort of like liberal critique of inequality.
I mean, because the truth is, at some level, I am. People could turn my story around and say, "Well, actually, you're proof that meritocracy works, right?" I'm a magazine editor in Manhattan. Who, you know, has
we're sitting in Matt's apartment. It's actually pretty nice.
who has you know, been educated at great schools and taught at another great school, and, you know,
you're proof positive the meritocracy. Yeah. You got
well, then if that's so, consider me a traitor to my whatever class you want to consider me in.
The best thing you can be is a traitor to your class.
But I would just say, to add to your point, I mentioned the Iraq War and torture and those issues, but you have to remember too, then the financial crash happened,
right?
And sort of a lot of these instincts I was starting to have about class kind of met a certain moment in our political history where those issues came to the fore very powerfully and were thrown into great relief,
right?
Right. So I don't want to. I didn't convert. It wasn't a Saul on the road to Damascus, bright light conversion. It was more, you know, questions, doubts, instincts, slowly being shaped. And then especially as the Iraq War went south, as the financial crash happened. And then I would say, this is where I will sound like a socialist bro podcaster, but I do think the Sanders campaign in 2015 and 2016, a lot of things clicked. Then. I'm not saying that's when I became a leftist. I think, you know, I was steadily moving left, but I do think kind of the aftermath of the financial crisis, kind of seeing sort of the failures of the Obama years, and then having almost a kind of morality tale of Bernie versus Hillary. There were really two different ways of conceiving of what had gone wrong in American life. And it was, in fact, my agitation. So about half of Bernie.
Yeah.
Michael Kazin said, "Matt, I notice you're kind of into Bernie, but you weren't like that when I met you when you were 23 years old. Why don't you write the story of how that happened?"
Right. Well, folks,
might be a good occasion to move on from my own biography.
I was going
to
say we I don't know how many minutes we are into the edited version of this podcast, maybe 20, 30 minutes, but we did just break the Bernie barrier. We mentioned Bernie Sanders and the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. We tricked you. This is actually a podcast where we relitigate the 2016 election. Every episode is going to be about a different day in 2016 and what happened on Twitter that day. And just stay tuned.
Stop the world and let me off. I'm tired of going.
My dreams are shattered. All right, so we should probably talk a little bit about what this podcast is actually going to be and what it's going to look like and why people should download it and keep listening next time. So my thought is that we will do episodes dedicated to individual thinkers or groups of thinkers on the right.
Or specific books or ideas even.
Books, yeah, for sure.
Documents, statements.
Yeah, right, manifestos.
Manifestos.
And I think that way, you know what you're getting into when you choose to listen to one of the podcasts. And I think that like we're both, you know, we also probably want to do a certain amount of degenerate punditry at various times. So we'll use those ideas as springboards to talk about what's going on in politics.
Right.
Though we'll try not to do that in a way that's totally useless to you. What might be some episodes that we do, Matt?
I mean, I have a long-standing interest in the conservative intellectual movement, kind of historically.
Yeah.
Who the major figures of it were, what institutions it spawned, the books that were produced, specific thinkers.
We should do the Nash book.
Yeah, like George H. Nash's book, talk about that. Specific thinkers, even that I have a odd fascination
personal,
with
personal relationship.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, like Bill Buckley, William F. Buckley. His teacher at Yale was a guy named Wilmore Kendall. And Kendall, well, he was a friend of one of my teachers at Georgetown, and he was someone when I was a young conservative I became fascinated by, so I read his books. And long story short, my old teacher, the late great George W. Carey, gave me an unpublished manuscript of his called The Long Farewell to Majority Rule.
Oh my God.
And I've long wanted an outlet for these weird fascinations. So here we are.
Here we are, folks. You're gonna get the good uncut shit.
Right. And they're things I can't like put in an essay. I can't write an essay about this guy who I had this weird fascination with in grad school. And yeah. Maybe I can, but it's perhaps better teased out in conversation.
I think we're both thinking of this as an opportunity to talk through some ideas that aren't ready for prime time. And that...
Well, I don't want to say that, but...
Well, I mean...
Prime
we
time.
We don't know where
this is
are.
Prime time.
Is it prime time? When do people listen to podcasts? I feel like the reading that I do on the right and about the right doesn't always have an obvious outlet to talk about.
Right.
And
I think that's a good way of putting it.
And we can bring some of that stuff to this space and talk about it. You know, you mentioning grad school reminds me that I have no formal training. I'm going to try not to sound too authoritative about things, even when I think I'm right.
Yeah.
Well,
I may sound authoritative sometimes. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm saying that like you actually, you know, you got most of a PhD.
Yeah. But it wasn't. I studied the history of political thought. You know, it's not like I got a PhD in conservatism or, you know.
I got the kind of fever dream nightmare of a liberal education at Brown where, like, I didn't have to take any, you know, courses on anything in particular. And, you know.
I'm sure it was all PC, it was
super,
multicultural.
Super PC,
you were just indoctrinated into multiculturalism.
Yeah, well,
you read no text from the West.
I actually haven't read into the Western canon at all. I'm pure that way.
I think it's worth maybe adding that Sam is not just a writer I admire, but my podcast.
Now we're getting to the best part of the podcast, folks.
But my friend, sort of your immersion in various texts and arguments of the left, and mine on the right means when we have conversations, there's often kind of an exchange.
Yeah,
I mean, in some ways, the podcast came out of our relationship as a writer and editor.
Yeah.
And some of the things you've written about for me, this 3,000-word essay you wrote on Jonah Goldberg, kind of a long book review essay. I mean, you talk about Albert J. Nock, you talk about kind of the conservative self-understanding, at least as it's expressed in that book. But then also you recently wrote a piece on Tucker Carlson for me.
Another real intellectual heavyweight.
a real heavyweight. But you did him the favor of taking the ideas he's putting forward seriously, which is to say that
they're terrifying.
And, well, not just terrifying, but they really have the possibility of gaining traction. And the left should realize
or not just, I think the left does realize this. I think it would be fair to say kind of the Democratic Party and whatever you want to call the broad center left should realize that they have, there's a real possibility they're going to be outflanked economically by some kind of welfare chauvinist, Tucker Carlson-esque kind of economic populism for white people.
Right. Reserve the benefits of redistribution for white people and the benefits of citizenship for white people.
Right. And I think mentioning like Goldberg's book along with Tucker Carlson and the writing you've done on it is a way of getting at some of what's behind the podcast in the sense of the history of conservatism matters and we're interested in that, but also the way some of these ideas are cashing out now.
Right.
And
so there is I would say that there is a way in which those two guys, though they may not be the like the kind of like intellectual firepower behind these positions, they are both sort of representative of competing tendencies in the Republican Party. Because in some way, Goldberg is a never Trump conservative. He still is an editor at National Review, and he's associated with AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, and he represents the kind of more traditional Buckleyite conservative tradition.
He would call himself kind of a classical liberal.
He would call himself a classical liberal.
Which is a distinct code word
saying that about themselves now.
Yeah.
The anti-Trump conservatives are saying that quite a lot. And what they're saying is that, you know, for one, he has a critique of Trump's character, which is sort of like a traditional moral character idea, which is endemic to the conservative tradition. And his critique is of his populism, right?
Right.
He's against Trump's populism and you know, thinks that the Republican Party has been taken over by these hooligan populists, or is in danger of being taken over, or the influence of people like him and Bill Kristol is on the wane in a treacherous way for the great tradition that we were talking about earlier, their perception of the great tradition. Whereas Tucker Carlson has fully embraced and surpassed Trump in his embrace of a kind of hair-invoked democracy, economic populism for white people, which is also kind of very much connected to a vision of the patriarch, that his great fear is that white men are less, are being, you know, aren't getting good jobs and are less marriageable, to use an economist's phrase. They're less likely to be able to provide for a family and therefore are not going to reproduce at sufficient enough rates to ensure the continued existence of a white American majority. And so the economic populism is rooted also in this kind of like eugenicist fear of the other, that's also obviously part of where both the Trumpian and Carlson's anti-immigrant impetus comes from. It's not just that these particular people who are coming in here now are bad, but it's that their children are going to be also you know, replacing white men in the workforce.
Right.
And so obviously, like, it's not a clean, there isn't like a clean competing tendencies within the Republican Party, but they have a conception, the people who are engaged in this battle do to some degree feel like there's a fight for the soul of the Republican Party. And I'm super interested in that.
No, I am too, and which is why the 2020 election will be super interesting, because it's like right now it's sort of a mix, right? The Republican Party, when you look at when Trump entered office, you know, Paul Ryan was Speaker of the House, and you kind of this kind of jostling among the traditional Republican type, the kind of Reaganite synthesis, jostling with the new Trumpist overlords.
Yeah.
And I think if Trump wins re-election, which he very well could, the Republican Party will be completely Trumpified,
right?
Or very nearly so,
right?
In a way that it's for all. I mean, obviously, most of these Republican office holders are cowards who have not really stood up to Trump. But you know, there's certain things that Trump hasn't gotten his way on everything, right?
Yeah.
They still passed massive tax cuts, which he was fine with, but they didn't repeal Obamacare. There's still, you know, a few people in office who, you know, however feebly, you know, aren't entirely on board. But
well,
I think
it's most of the stuff that they're not on board with is the trade stuff and the stuff that looks something like the right embracing a kind of like working white working class focus,
right.
abandoning kind of ideas of laissez-faire economics, and sort of just being more comfortable with defending economic redistribution as such, as long as it benefits the right people.
Right.
And I think that, yeah, certainly Goldberg is somebody who just looks on it in horror at the Trump policies.
Yeah.
That, like, the trade policies, which are, like, you know, they're just incoherent. You know, they don't make sense. But that, because it was such a sacred cow, the idea of free trade and of the free movement of capital.
I think
that an interesting thing to talk about is what's happening with what Trump 2020 is going to be like. And I think that in this context, because I think that what we are seeing to some degree is the reason he's leaning to this completely horrifying, sociopathic degree into demonizing immigrants is that that's kind of like, that's all he has. That's all he really has to hold on to of the, like, of this economic populist thing. You know, he didn't, you know, he's given up on defending, you know, Medicaid and Medicare like he did during his budget includes massive cuts to both of those programs and to Social Security. That's a win for the traditional Goldberg type right. So he doesn't really have any legs to stand on in terms of economic populism, with the exception of the trade stuff and with exception of, obviously, the affective performance of, anger towards a certain kind of elite, which is, you know, an effete liberal person of color, basically. Or effete white liberals who protect people of color at the expense of white working class people. Mm-hmm. He still has that rhetoric and that affect, but he doesn't really have any policies to show for it. He passed a massive tax cut for the wealthy, a tax cut which is going to harm middle and working class people more and more over time because they'll see their, because of the way that they did the numbers. So I think that one of the explanations for why Trump has been just absolutely so crazed, besides that he's like a genuinely racist man who just... we were talking about today about him saying that he would release the detained immigrants into
sanctuary cities,
because he imagines that if that happens, that they'll all just go rape and pillage. He thinks, oh, well, I've really got them now, because none of these mayors would ever be like, yeah, bring us those guys.
Yeah.
But like, actually, like, no, they're regular people. They're just, you know, they'd be in a city. But anyway, so I'm saying that like the obsessive focus on the migration stuff is because that's all he has. That is part of the populist thing, because it's not just racism as such, or it's not just we hate the other, we fear the other. It's that the other is going to replace us, undermine our ability,
or benefit at our expense.
They're going to benefit at our expense. So I think you're going to see more and more of that. I think that like Trump is going to have some kind of response, especially if a Bernie or Warren candidate comes to the front of the Democratic pack. They're going to be making like a really strong and I think compelling argument that they have an economic populist vision, that they support expanding Social Security, whereas Trump wants to, you know, curtail it, that Medicare and Medicaid or Medicare for All, which is a popular policy, whatever. There's going to be they'll go back to a kind of like, they want to help the wrong people, you know, because like welfare reform and the Reagan era attacks on welfare in some ways were relying on the idea that welfare only helps the wrong people. It only helps the black people and the immigrants and the immoral poor. And we haven't heard a whole ton of that in the Trump era. But I think we might hear that again, or a version of it that's less focused on black people in America, but focused on immigrants. That like Bernie's Medicare for All bill is going to help undocumented families at the expense of working class people who have good insurance already or whatever.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I do think it's true that if you look at Trump's rhetoric in the 2016 campaign he ran, he didn't demonize like quote unquote welfare per se.
Yeah.
Right?
No, not at all.
It was, his stoking of racial and ethnic resentment was very clearly connected to immigration, building the wall.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, his argument wasn't,
welfare benefits. He wasn't talking about welfare queens driving right. Cadillacs like Reagan did.
Yeah.
But I do think you're right that that could, that's almost the last button he really has to push,
yeah.
Given his record of governing.
As a plutocrat.
Yeah.
And I think like.
Oh, and I wanted to say, this is where, I don't want to rely too much on anecdotes, but, you know, I mentioned where I grew up, and I have family members I'm friends with on Facebook. And the political memes they share, I shouldn't be shocked or surprised, but it's really telling that the number of sort of like graphics that I've seen posted that say something like, if you're a hardworking American, you can barely afford healthcare or to put a roof over your head and whatever. But if an immigrant walks across, or a migrant walks across the border, they get free healthcare, they just get tons of free shit.
Yeah.
And obviously this is wildly
right.
untrue, but it's I've noticed that percolating more.
Yeah.
To tie this back to some of the conservative intellectual history.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the competing tendencies of like a Jonah Goldberg versus a Tucker Carlson. One of the things I think is interesting is that like Jonah Goldberg's political views have almost no popular support in the United States, which is to say economic, maybe not libertarianism, but you know, free market, maximalist defensive capitalism combined with, I mean, whatever else you want to say about Jonah Goldberg, like he was a fairly early conservative to get on board with gay marriage.
Right.
You know, so a kind of economic libertarianism and social liberalism, or at least queasiness about fighting the culture wars.
Right.
Almost no one in the United States believes that.
Right. There's that great chart that shows right.
The four quadrants. Yeah.
There's nobody in the quadrant that is
essentially Jonah Goldberg or even me. I mean, I don't know. Bill Kristol was kind of a cultural conservative, but which is to say that there's always been this tension, I think, in movement conservatism between what the official ideas are mm-hmm. and the popular base right. of the movement. And I think in terms of, that might not be an explicit topic on this podcast, but I think that tension will inform a fair amount of what we discuss, because you can read George H. Nash's The Conservative Intellectual Movement in America since 1945, and it's all basically the fusionism that was found in the pages of National Review.
What's that fusion between what and
what? The marriage of kind of economic libertarianism, cultural conservatism, or kind of traditional values, and Cold War anti-communism.
Yeah.
And after the Cold War, then a sort of muscular pro-America foreign policy.
Yeah.
That kind of, those intellectual ideas that were the kind of the official ideology of movement conservatives and the popular base, which was, you know, inextricably bound up with massive resistance to desegregation and busing and things like that.
Right.
And you kind of, there's this, maybe we'll do an episode on Bill Buckley's campaign for mayor in New York City.
We should.
Which was, you know, it's interesting, like the ideas that he was putting forward in National Review, or the kind of the official theory of conservatism, and basically what Buckley realized, or what happened in that mayoral campaign was, you know, kind of realizing that these white ethnics in the outer boroughs were prime for the pickings for conservative politicians. So that tension, I think, is a sort of an interesting one in the history of conservatism.
And as I've sort of like mentioned before when we talk about this, I would be interested too in teasing out the ways in which those things are more compatible than they seem to be, right?
Perhaps.
There's a tension.
Perhaps,
there's a tension there.
A tension,
between
but
a
not
certain
a
kind of elite conservative intellectual tradition and the kind of popular base, which is, you know, more invested in cultural conservatism and racism, to put it bluntly. But I think that actually we would be remiss if we didn't investigate the way that those things actually are co-constitutive or complicatedly connected in ways that aren't contradictory.
Mm-hmm. Hitchens always would say, so this is the advantage of thinking dialectically.
It is. It's a great advantage. I was reminded when you mentioned the Cold War that another thing that I think we should consider doing episodes about is about transitions, like what intellectuals of the left became intellectuals of the right, and who have mm-hmm. gone the other way. We were talking about this earlier today. I mean, obviously, everybody always talks about the sort of Jewish Trotskyite New York folks, mm-hmm. some of whom became the neocons, right? Bill Kristol's father and, you know, John Potteritz.
His father. Norman.
Norman and Irving. But of course...
You know that joke about John Podoritz, right? Because he was like a speechwriter, maybe for, I don't know, for Reagan, but maybe Dan Quayle. Uh-huh. And when he first moved to Washington, you know, he was always introduced as, you know, Norman Podoritz's son. Yeah, so the joke became...
As he still is
to me. Yeah, so the joke was everyone called him John P. Normanson.
That's good.
Is that...
Yeah, that might be anti-Semitic. Matt just asked me off mic if that was anti-Semitic.
But John P. Normanson.
I think it might be. This podcast is going to be a great friend to anti-Semitism on the left. We're going to have Ilhan Omar on to talk about.
Yeah, specialist.
Ilhan Omar, the bravest politician in America, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, when you want to tease out the kind of intellectual traditions, it can be really useful to see these people who have gone through a big transition. I mean, obviously, that's part of what we were talking about Matt. He's useful to us, but also, you know, those guys and
I mean, even Ronald Reagan was a convert in some ways.
Right. He was
from New Deal liberal to an anti. He was a union leader.
Right. Of
the Screen Actors Guild, I think.
Right. And then he just got... And then there was whoever that guy was who put him in those anti-communist...
Those General Electric,
anti-communist propaganda videos. Mm-hmm. And he was like, actually, I love saying this stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say this stuff for the rest of my life.
An episode on his renowned speech on behalf of Barry Goldwater.
Yes.
Which was televised.
Right.
It'll melt your face off when you watch it.
But also about people who went from right to left, which is a fascinating phenomenon too, and which you know, it would be interesting to sort of see if we can establish any kind of like historical trajectory. Are more people prominently moving one way or the other now? There's some, you know, we were talking earlier about Elizabeth Warren.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yeah. I mean, she was registered at least as a Republican. I think in her own official statements, she kind of acts like she was sort of apolitical. She wasn't even sure, you know. Yeah. But it was just today, I think, a piece about her came out in Politico that looked at this and her move from right to left, or at least registered Republican to Democrat. And I think during the time she was a young legal scholar, the law and economics stuff was prominent in the legal academy, which she was involved with. And basically she was doing work on like foreclosures or bankruptcy and expected to investigate it and find all these people were like ripping off the government or taking advantage of loopholes, fraud. Yeah. And she realized actually the system was rigged against these people. And that was, so she actually looked at the data. This speaks very well of her intellectual integrity. She looked at the data. She looked at the information that's available and then, you know, kind of moved left, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
But there's some other examples. Do you know Michael Lind?
Yes.
He wrote a book called Up From Conservatism in the 90s. He was like Bill Buckley's protege almost. Right. And that's, you know, and he's playing off Bill Buckley's book, Up From Liberalism, which itself was a somewhat grotesque ripoff of Booker T. Washington, right? Up From Slavery.
Right. Wow. So there's no shortage of grotesquery on the right. But I was going to say about Liz Warren is I think, like, I don't think we're going to find that many examples of people who, quote unquote, looked at the facts and decided to change their political ideology.
Right.
Especially as I get deeper into reading about affect theory. And I think my new slogan is that contra, what's his name?
Ben Shapiro.
Yeah. It's not that facts don't care about your feelings. It's that feelings don't care about your facts.
Right.
Yeah. And in fact, or facts, most of the time, are also just feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
And that their political motivations don't come from a clear-eyed reading of empirical reality. Have we covered what we want to cover?
I think this is a good start.
Okay.
Or it's at least a start.
Yeah, it's a start. I'm going to edit it and make myself sound really cool and smart. And make Matt sound really like a blowhard who never stops talking about himself. And
you're going to deepen your voice.
I am. Yeah. I've got all these effects. But yeah, I mean, hopefully this is remotely interesting to anybody besides me and Matt.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? If people don't care about the right, it's worth saying the right cares about them.
That's good. Yeah, exactly. The right does. Right. I mean, this is something that I said to Matt earlier today, which is that in some ways, the real fundamental preoccupation of the conservative movement is not tradition. It's not capitalism. It's not liberty or freedom. It's the left.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're obsessed with us, so we should become slightly more obsessed with them.
I agree.
All right. This is Know Your Enemy. Listen next time for more knowledge of your enemy. Thanks, Matt.
Bye.
He called me baby, all night long. Used to hold and kiss me till the dawn. Then one day I awoke and he was gone. There's no more baby all night long.
The podcast where we
call me what do we do?
Calm down. Have another beer.